So we're studying Luke 12, 13 to 21 to begin with. Thank you.
Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or arbitrator over you?" And he said to them, "Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And he told them a parable, saying, "The land of a rich man produced plentifully. And he thought to himself, 'What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops.' And he said, 'I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God.'"
Okay, that ending there implies a lot, but we'll talk about that before we get done. But we want to go back. First of all, I want to take you to verse 15 for just a minute and ask you to note one word in there. He said, "Then he said to them," Jesus is speaking to the crowd, "beware." And the beware in this case is a little bit of a way of helping understand the flow of this particular chapter. So let's go back up to chapter 12, verse 1, and just get the feel for the venue and what's going on in Jesus doing this teaching that we heard. It says, "Under these circumstances," and it goes back up, "he left scribes and Pharisees who were very hostile to him." They would have been very content to have killed him then if they thought they could have gotten away with it. "But under these circumstances, so many thousands of people had gathered together that they were stepping on one another." So here's Jesus at a gathering. We don't know exactly where, but there are thousands of people, and they're there crowded to the point they're literally stepping on one another, trying to get close to Jesus. So, all of these people around. Now, keep in mind that some of those people would be there in the crowd who were followers of the scribes and Pharisees, hostile to Jesus. Okay? Because it was under these circumstances. That's the start of the verse there. "He began saying to his disciples, first of all." So, Jesus starts to preach. Others get to hear, but of first importance to the disciples. And according to what I read here, generally the commentators say, this isn't a word that would mean the 12. This means the learners. This is a broader context. So he starts preaching to those that still wanted to learn from him that weren't there just to attack him. And so that was his priority. And we get this, "Beware. Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy." So he gives them a warning about those Pharisees, and he said, "There's nothing covered up that won't be revealed and hidden that will not be known. Accordingly, what you said in the dark will be heard in the light, and what you whispered in the inner rooms will be proclaimed upon the housetops." In other words, hypocrisy will be revealed. And the chief hypocrites are the scribes and the Pharisees. And so he's pointing out to them, these people who seem so spiritual, he's pointing out to them, these people that seem so spiritual are hypocrites, and all the secret things are going to come out. And I say, my friends, in verse 4, don't be afraid of those who kill the body, and that's all they can do. He's taking them out of the physical considerations, "but I will warn you whom you fear. Fear the one who, after he has killed, has authority to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him." So he's taking them to a spiritual level. "Are not 5 sparrows sold for 2 cents, yet not one of them is forgotten before God?" He's getting this spiritual connection with them, talking about the spiritual life, the very hairs of your head are numbered. This is a lot like Matthew 6, right? That's where we read, typically we'll read this kind of teaching. "Don't fear, you're more valuable than many sparrows." So he's connecting them with God. And then he goes on to really talk about, he doesn't go into the gospel, so to speak, but he begins to talk about the topic in general of salvation. "And I say to you, everyone who confesses me before men, the Son of Man will confess him also before the angels of God. But he who denies me before men will be denied before the angels of God. And everyone who speaks a word against the Son of Man, it will be forgiven him. But he who blasphemes against the Holy Spirit, it won't be forgiven him. And so he's given them the spiritual instruction and warning them about not rejecting the Holy Spirit and giving credit for the work of the Holy Spirit to something or someone else. When they bring you before the synagogues and the rulers and authorities, don't worry about how or what you are to speak in your defense or what you're to say. The Holy Spirit will teach you in that very hour what you ought to say. So he brings this strong connection with the Holy Spirit, with the Father, and with himself in this spiritual connection. And, oh, who's the enemies? When you're in front of the synagogues, before the rulers, that's going to be the Sanhedrin or similar. Don't worry about what to say. So he's engaging them in this battle with the Jewish leadership and with these hypocritical leaders and the scribes and the Pharisees. So you're going through all this really almost heavenly discussion. If you acknowledge me, I'm going to acknowledge you before the angels. I mean, this is pretty heady stuff in the spiritual world. In the midst of all that, someone in the crowd says, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." Now, what kind of a context is that? Okay, so someone in the crowd, we don't know if he's someone who wants to be taught or is an enemy. There's a whole lot we don't know here, and there really isn't much point in trying to figure it out, although we can read between the lines and get some of it. You know, according to the Jewish custom and law at that time, did he deserve the inheritance at that point? We don't know. We don't have any idea. We don't know what had gone on. Now, we can say, when you start talking about inheritance in the Jewish regime, if you go back to the Old Testament, if you go back to Deuteronomy and Numbers, the way inheritance worked was you didn't divide it between all the kids. Now, eventually it was come to be that the oldest one would get two portions and everybody else would get one. But originally, it was the oldest got it all. And then he would, like if you got the family farm, then he would operate the business, if you will, of that farm for everyone in the family's benefit. It wouldn't be just for him and his family alone, but he would operate it for everybody. But it stayed as a unit and stayed then. It was Dad operated it, right? And Dad operated it for the benefit of everybody. Well, Dad's gone. The oldest brother takes over and he operates it for the benefit of everybody. And that kind of but we were long since gone on that. And so the point here isn't, I'm not getting my legal just dessert somewhere. What's this guy interested in?
His inheritance.
I want my stuff. Or I want maybe not my stuff. I just want some stuff. I might not even be deserved it. Jesus doesn't even get into that. But this guy just says, hey, tell my brother. So, an interesting thing about this, he does address him. Teacher, tell my brother. Well, the word he uses for teacher here is the same word for rabbi. And the rabbis would do this kind of thing. The rabbis kind of acted in many locales as somewhat judges over the issues because they were the ones that were teaching them how the law, the Old Testament, would tell them to behave. And so they would be the ones to say, well, according to the... And they went beyond the Old Testament. They had their own traditions as well. But according to the law and the traditions, you should or you shouldn't. And they would make these kinds of things. It's still kind of wildly out of context. Just teaching along and all of a sudden, boom, make him give me half or give me my portion, whatever that means. And so that's kind of where it all starts. But notice then we get the other beware. So Jesus then has just finished teaching about beware of the hypocritical leadership of the scribes and Pharisees, and now he gets to do a beware about the physical aspect of living in the sense of greed. But he said to him, man, who appointed me judge or arbitrator over you? Now that term man there, in our vernacular, we might use that as just a way to address somebody, right? But this word here is out of that, not in that context. This, we might say the word mister. It's like, it's a distance showing thing. I don't know you. We're not connected. So, sir, why are you asking me this? It's kind of one of those, I don't know you. I'm going to give you a term with some respect, but it also shows some distance here. Who appointed me a judge and arbitrator over you? So he basically says, what are you interrupting for? I mean, it's not quite that bad, but almost. And then he said to him, said to them, so now he talks to the whole group, said to the man, sir, why are you asking me to do this? Nobody appointed me in this role. But he said to the group then, be on your guard, beware and be on your guard. So he's emphasizing it twice. This is important. Be aware of it and be careful about it. Be on your guard against every form of greed. So that's where the teaching is going. And I think it's very clear from that comment and from the way that this young man spoke, I don't know how young he was, that he definitely had an issue with greed, didn't he? He wanted stuff. And then Jesus says something that is just really strong and good. For not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions. And, you know, that is certainly a true statement. And he's going to tell them a parable to bring that out. But along the way, let's borrow from a couple other folks that said something similar. Before I do, though, I need to talk about a word. Because that does his life consist of his possessions? That word life there, I know others have made a pretty significant issue out of this word, deservedly. And it's the word zoe. And life here doesn't mean living, doesn't mean being alive. It's not the opposite of being dead. It's really like we would say to somebody, get a life. You know, you're so caught up in something over here. You're so focused on that. You're missing out on what's really going on around you and in the world. Get a life. Get, you know, you're kind of dead walking the way you're going at this. And so this means life, the significance of life. Okay, so the significance of life is not found in possessions, even for the one who has an abundance. Let's go over to 2 Timothy 6, 6 through 10. Excuse me, I did that when I was studying too. Let's try 1 Timothy 6, 6 through 10. There aren't even six of those in 2 Timothy. If somebody wants to read that, that would be just fine.
Now, godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain that we carry nothing out. And having food and clothing, and these will shall be content. But those who desire to be rich full into the temptation and the snare and into many of the foolish and harmful lusts which drown men in destruction and perdition.
Okay, one more.
For the love of the money is the root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed in the faith and their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows.
Okay, so here's Paul talking to Timothy, training this young man up to be a even more effective pastor, and he starts teaching about the love of money. But to start with, he gives him the good side. But godliness is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. So here's the two things that need to come together to have the great gain. Godliness and contentment. And interestingly enough, he doesn't say having enough to be contented. He just says having contentment. Being content with what you have in essence. But it's of great gain when accompanied by contentment. Verse 7, we brought nothing in the world and we're taking nothing out. Pretty simple, straightforward understanding there. And so verse 8, if we have food and covering with these, we shall be content. That's not much, is it? And by the way, you can have one day's worth and you have it, right? So Paul says, if we've got something to eat and we're covered up, we're good to go. We're content. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation. He didn't say are likely to be tempted, might have trouble. But if your focus is you want to be rich, then and that's your focus, then you will fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. So, you know, Paul said in another passage, you know, I've learned how to be content with a lot and with a little. So he's been there, he's lived it, he's seen it, and certainly he's saying those that are focused on becoming rich are likely to find themselves in these spaces. Verse 10, for the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, and some longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. So that love of money is not a good thing, according to Paul. We'll probably say a little bit more about that before we're done, because we don't want to swing the pendulum to where we have gone someplace else than where the Bible goes. Let's go over to Ecclesiastes 5, 10 through 12. We certainly know Solomon was experienced in having a few dollars. They wouldn't have called them dollars then, but he was not poor, was he? So we get to hear his comments about what he has observed about money. So Ecclesiastes 5, 10 through 12.
When goods increase, they are increased that eat them. And what good cometh to the owners thereof, but the beholding thereof with their eyes? Sleep of him.
I don't think you're in the right spot, Don.
Where?
Ecclesiastes 5, 10 through 12.
Yeah, I did. Goods increase. Ecclesiastes 5, 10. Okay, somebody else read it. This one says 10 there, so maybe the numbering is different.
He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. This too is vanity. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. So what is the advantage to their owners except to look on? The sleep of the working man is pleasant, but whether he eats little or much. But the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep.
So what does Solomon say about loving money?
It's vanity.
You won't be satisfied, will you?
No.
He who loves money will not be satisfied with money. Okay? Nor will he who loves abundance with its income. It's all vanity. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. Anybody notice it would have been a week ago about, there was somebody won a big lottery. I didn't pay too much attention to it. And now that I was preparing for this, I wish I'd pay a little more attention to it. But there was a person that was even going to court. They had a winning ticket for millions and millions of dollars. I don't know how much it was, but lots and lots and lots. 500 and some million dollars. And they didn't want to claim their ticket until they got the courts to say they could do it anonymously, because the law for that one said that they had to give their name and then they could be used in promotions going forward. One of the little fine print things on buying a lottery ticket. So why didn't they want to give their name?
They didn't want that many friends.
Yeah. They had so many friends they didn't know what to do with them all. Isn't that what Solomon says?
Yep.
You know, when good things increase, those who consume them increase. Some years ago, in preparing for something for a class, I don't remember what class I was teaching, but I wound up bumping into some research on people who won lotteries. And the bulk of them, you know, I could give you some statistics I kind of remember. The bulk of them, almost without fail, go bankrupt within a number of years. And the reason partly is they get to spending so fast that by the time they realize they're running out, they can't get stopped. We shut down a business one time back in the 80s, and that was the interesting thing about the business. We decided, okay, we're going to quit this. We were in okay shape financially, but money had to keep going everywhere over the next few months till you got everything woed up. It's like, stop! You know, it's like a river flowing. You decide you're not going to let the river flow anymore. Oh no, it's going to flow for a while. But anyway, one of the aspects of it was so expensive. I mean, not percentage-wise maybe, but as soon as you win the lottery, now you, you know, the people that I read about, they had to move to a gated community. They had to go with live guards. I mean, they couldn't just have some sort of gating and, you know, automatic let me in. They had to have that, and then they had to change all their phone numbers, and they couldn't talk to people, and they had to have somebody that would accept all their phone calls for them so they could screen them out. I mean, it just keeps going and going and going and going. And then, of course, they had all that to worry about, right? Worried about trying to figure out how to keep some of it, or worried about how to make friends by how they spend it or whatever. I don't know. But anyway, the folks that win a lot of big chunks of money, it doesn't work out so good. And so this is what we learn from the book of Ecclesiastes. If you love money, even when you get it, you're not satisfied. There's the famous Rockefeller quote. Did I got the right guy? The oil guy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, John D. Rockefeller. You know, and he's the richest man in the world at the time. And not just by a little bit more. He was mega, mega rich. And they asked him, well, how much is enough? And he goes, a little bit more. And that's the way it stayed all of his life. So here's Jesus saying, beware of greed, all forms of it. It's kind of like, is there more than one kind? And apparently Jesus is saying, yeah, it doesn't matter. If you're like, I got to get this, that's greed, and that's not where you want to live. Beware of it, be on your guard. And so this is where he goes with that. In verse 16, he tells them the parable. So what's the parable? Tell me the parable. What's the story? What's that?
It's a build more barn with money.
Well, build more barns, but if you go back and look at the beginning of it, you've got a rich man. So he didn't start out poor in the story. Now, this is just a story. Man doesn't really exist, right? That's parables. But you got a rich man was very productive. His land worked very well. Okay? And he began reasoning to himself, saying, what shall I do since I have no place to store my crops? So this guy has a problem. I mean, it's expressed as a problem, right? What am I going to do? I don't have enough storage for everything. Now, what are some answers you might come up with for this?
Give it away.
Okay, give it away.
Build more storage.
Well, and that's where he went.
Sell it.
Sell it. Well, if we work our way through that, what we could use as an example, the orange growers. When they grow oranges, do they sell them all?
No,
why not?
Drive the market.
That's right. They decide how many oranges they want in the market, provided they've got a good crop. The years they're short, it's easy for them. They sell everything they got because they don't have enough. But in the good years, and if you go study the Sunkist Corporation and some others, they're really good at this. They have excess oranges. So why don't they just sell them all? Well,
price goes down.
Price goes down. That's not profitable. That's this guy's problem. I've got enough stuff. I could put a glut on the market. Why don't you give it away?
Don't make any money that way.
Well, that's even worse than selling it, right? Now you're giving it away for free. You talk about a glut on the market. Yeah, and so... Yeah, there are hogs that get to eat oranges every year, usually, most years, if they have a good year, and other kinds of things like that. So they find other markets where they can still sell them. Now, this isn't a real guy, so we're supposing, but if you put yourself in somebody who's greedy, I mean, that's what Jesus is teaching about, right, greed? He's not going to just try to figure out how to make good use of the product. He's going to try to figure out how to get the most profit from the product. And so he's got a problem. And I know growing up around my grandfather, he was a very good farmer. And I learned a lot from him about, well, yeah, I got this big wheat harvest, but I'm not selling it now. I'm going to go get it stored and then
sell it later
when the prices aren't, when, you know, when it's not such a glut. And he did that with a number of different crops, and he managed it well. Now, you can be a good business manager without being greedy, but we'll talk about that a little more later. But he said, this is what I'm going to do. I don't want to glut the market or whatever. We don't know what he was thinking. By the way, who was his chief counsel? Himself. Okay. So he says, I'm going to tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I'll store all my grain and my goods. This is going to be good. I'll have this great big tall silo or whatever full of all my goods. And I will say to my soul, Now, this is an interesting thing. Talking to the very depths of himself. Oh, by the way, who's he talking to now again?
Himself.
Soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. What's that mean? I don't have to worry about anything anymore, right?
I can retire.
Take, interestingly enough, that's what take your ease means to the Jewish hearer. Retire. You don't have to work anymore. You've got it made. You're done with all the challenge of life. Retire. Eat, drink, and be merry. Now that last part really clues us into the kind of person Jesus is describing. Eat, drink, and be merry. In today's world, we could call that hedonism, if you're familiar with the term. But it's go seek the pleasures of life. I'm just going to seek pleasure. Almost go back to Ecclesiastes. Isn't that what Solomon did? And what did he say? That's worthless. But this guy hasn't discovered that yet, apparently. Now, this isn't a real guy. But Jesus is saying, this is the attitude you've got to watch out for. Already got plenty of stuff. Get a whole bunch more. It's a problem. So I've got to figure out how to get this so I've got it. It's greed in one of its very simplest forms. I've got to manage this and take care of it. Oh, and once I get the stuff I want due to my greed, I've got the ground, I've got the production, I've got the crops. Oh, I've got it made. And so Jesus in this parable says, but God said to him, you fool, strongest of words, empty-headed, non-thinking idiot, you fool. This very night your soul is required of you, and who now will own what you've prepared? Now, Jesus doesn't go into it. We could add to it, and what you really need, you don't have. But I want to back up to, and it says, because I found this fascinating, there is an idiom used here, a particular way that the Jews talked. When it says your soul is required of you, literally it says, they require your soul. That's how they talked about death. A plural requires your soul. And that they is a plural there. And several of the commentators say they think that's a reference to, in the Old Testament, why did they say plural? That's because they would usually often use the term Elohim for God, which is a plural. And so they would say Elohim, well, God, the plural they, that's the they they're thinking about. And of course, the commentator is saying it would apply, we could look at it the same way, that we could be talking about the Trinity. But it's God himself. It isn't just you're going to die, but God is saying, I'm requiring your soul. What does that imply?
You're
going to die.
Maybe that he's given his soul to something else and it's not available.
And judgment.
Yes, judgment.
Which is he gave his soul to something else. And so now what are you going to bring to judgment? Your soul's required. Here's your soul in front of God. What are you going to do now?
If you look at Joseph, Joseph basically was told to do the same thing with a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, that's just an outstanding example. And I want to come back to that. I hadn't thought of that when I was searching for the right example. And you gave it to me because I had not considered that one. But let's go down to verse 21. So is the man who stores up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. Live a selfish life. Live a self-centered life. Live a life that's focused on you having your treasure and your wealth and not rich toward God, not seeing yourself as a steward of those things. You're like this guy and you're a fool. I mean, that's really what Jesus says. I mean, that's the connection. You fool. Okay, you're like him if you are a person who's just trying to hoard up your treasure and are not rich toward God. So how would the behaviors look different for a person who is rich toward God? Is it possible for someone who is, quote, rich toward God to have a very productive, in this case, farm?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Is it possible that a person who's rich toward God might have a bountiful crop one year that's just beyond his wildest dreams?
So sure.
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen it. So How does the person that's rich toward God behave differently?
He would ask God how to share it.
He's not going to take counsel himself, is he? Hey, God, I don't know what you've got in mind here. Where are we going with this? Or, I think this is probably what you want. Would you help? Would you give me some indication? Help me know I'm on the right track. Oh, what does the Bible say that a person would extra supposed to do? Let's go do a little study and figure out where God would. How can I apply God's principles to this excess that I don't normally have? Well, by the way, if he's a rich person, he doesn't have to wait until the bountiful harvest, does he? If he's, you know, if we look over at Paul's example, if I've got enough to eat today and clothes to wear, I'm content. If you use that for the cutoff, if you have more than that, you're rich. Who's not rich? Nobody you know. Nobody I know, and certainly not me. I mean, I'm not in the not rich category. Like all those double negatives. You know, so we're all in that rich category, and so then shouldn't we already be doing those things? God, here's the stuff. What do you want me to do with it? Oh, by the way, is any of it yours? Not really. So can we say that being rich is the problem?
No.
However, go back to what Paul said. A lot of people in rich that love money. It's real easy when you get a little to start to like that, isn't it? Have you liked having some money in the bank account or in your billfold or even just for today having a little extra? Isn't that kind of nice once in a while? So it's easy to get caught up in that and to start to love that money instead of see yourself as a steward over it. So we got to be careful about what Paul said. We don't want to just pass it on and say, oh, it's okay to be rich. Don't worry about it. No, watch out for the greed. Paul says that love of money gets a lot of people, drags them down really deep, destroys them, is the way Paul talks about it. So if we've got some money, we better be super careful. We better do what Jesus said. Beware of greed. Not only beware of greed, be on guard. Be watching for it. Don't let it enter your life and disrupt you. And then I think we would be remiss if we didn't go back. First of all, I want to go back to Don's example, because here is an excellent example of somebody who became rich. Joseph, did he become rich? Oh, yeah, he became rich. He was number two to Pharaoh, and the way Pharaoh talked about it, you can have up to half my kingdom. He didn't just say you can have dominion over it. It's yours. But how did Joseph manage it? Joseph managed it for the good of Egypt. And he managed the dominion that he had as a government official over Egypt then to go out and to really take care of this famine that he knew was coming. And so he managed that wealth on God's behalf. And really that's what is up to us to do. It wasn't this parable, but I remember a lot of years ago, there couldn't be more than three or four people around that could even have known this person, and I hope you can't figure out who it was if you happen to be one of those three or four. But I was preaching on, you know, if you're absolutely sure that God has placed in front of you a need in his kingdom, and you've got money in the bank that's for your retirement, but you know that's what God, what you know that needs done, and you've got it, and God's clearly placed in front of you, the safest thing you can do with that retirement is to give it and trust God for your retirement. And of course, this person answers, what do you want to do, live in a ditch? Now, I'm not trying to be too critical of that person. Unfortunately, they're not here and nobody really knows them. But do you see the attitude that displays? Now, obviously, few of us are going to be in a situation where we really know. And a lot of people coming up in their retirement years get bilked by people. So I don't want you out looking for a place to just give all your retirement money. That's not my point. My point is, if that's really what God is directing you to do, you are more likely, you have improved your probability of making it through your retirement years by giving your retirement away if you're doing what God's asking you, truly asking you to do. That's a safer place to be. And I want to take you to the verses that follow this parable to show that to you. Look at verse 22. And he said to his disciples, for this reason. So we can't skip these verses because he's going back to, if you're not rich toward God and you store up treasures, you're a fool. For this reason, I say to you, don't worry about your life as to what you will eat, nor for your body as to what you will put on, for life is more than food, and the body is more than clothing. Consider the ravens, for they neither sow nor reap. They have no storeroom nor barn, and yet God feeds them. How much more valuable are you than birds? And which of you by worrying can add a single hour to his life? If you can't even do a very little thing, why do you worry about other matters? Consider the lilies. They grow, they don't toil or spin. But I tell you, not even Solomon in all his glory was clothed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the furnace, how much more will he clothe you, O men of little faith? And do not seek what you will eat and what you will drink, and do not keep worrying, for all these things the nations of the world eagerly seek. But your Father knows you need them. Seek his kingdom, and these things will be added to you. Don't be afraid, little flock, for your Father has chosen gladly to give you the kingdom. Think about that for a minute. Sell your possessions, give to charity, make yourselves money belts which do not wear out, an unfailing treasure in heaven where no thief comes near nor moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Pretty strong words from Jesus himself. And the number one point of this is, where are you going to find your security? In your cash? In your 401k? No. Your security comes from the fact you have a loving Heavenly Father that knows what you need. He sees you, and he's going to care for you. You're more important than the birds that he's already taken care of day by day. So you can have great confidence in going forward that God will take care of you. Now, you can't escape the fact that there have been Christians that have starved to death and a few other things. So can we say, well, that negates all this? No. God does his purposes, and he does, and he will use the events of life and the hardships that come to you as a part of fulfilling his purposes. You can't skip James chapter 1 either. Consider it all joy when you encounter various trials. Okay? Well, those trials come, and those things occur. If we look at our funds like they're ours, we're already in trouble. If we look at the funds God has entrusted us with like they're God's funds, and we're going to be rich toward God with our funds, then we're in a pretty good space if we act on that belief. You were going to say something.
Well, one of my favorite excuses to counter that, which it really is the idea that, you know, the church was supposed to take care of people when they got old and stuff, but the church, by and large, has abandoned that to government. Who knows what government's going to do? But in actuality, it doesn't even consider men in the situation here when it's talking in the verses. So my objection is not valid anyway.
Well, because he doesn't say the church is going to take care of you. Who does he say is going to take care of you? The other thing I would say is prudent planning is upheld in the scriptures. So the old comment, you know, and he doesn't mean it, it's not used for financial, but who's going to start a tower before he first counts the cost? Think about what it's meaning to live the Christian life. Don't launch off into that without realizing it's a costly life to live. That's the point of that parable. But at the same time, you know, there are... You know, if we go over and start reading Proverbs, you know, in the house of the wise, you'll find oil and food. You're going to find things. They don't run out. They don't consume everything every day. They store up. And so I think you could quickly say that it's not wrong to prepare for your retirement. As a matter of fact, I think in today's world, means we're provided with it, we'd be remiss if we didn't do what we could do. Not everybody's going to do the same thing. But whatever life's condition gives us, whatever we can do to prepare and realize that that's coming, I think it's just wise and reasonable for us to do that. I talk about that because that's what I'm looking at coming up in my future. But you could look at any point along the way in terms of being wise with money is wisdom. Okay? And God does bless by getting us in a spot where we're not having to maybe struggle every day. God will also bless by putting us in a place where we have to struggle every day. We have to trust God that he's going to do his purposes in our life with the conditions we find ourselves in. But when we do get some funds, if we look at them as ours and not God's, we're in trouble. We want to be rich toward God. I've actually preached Matthew 6 a number of times. I really love that passage. But there's one part of the passage in Luke I like a little better. I just like these words. Make yourselves money belts which don't wear out. I just like that picture. An unfailing treasure in heaven. You don't have to worry about thieves, and you don't have to worry about destruction. And boy, things just don't last very long. The older I get, the more I know. Things just don't last very long. So this life is very temporal. The things that we accumulate are very temporal. The value of the things we accumulate, even if it's something that didn't wear out, is very temporal. This just came to mind, and you'll have to forgive me for it. I used to love to listen to Paul Harvey's Rest of the Story. I don't know if anybody else liked that or not. But he talked about one, and I think it was in the 1800s, but I might be off. And he talked about what they were selling at auction, and in today's terms, they would be selling for tens and twenties and $50,000 a piece. Now, in its day, it sold a lot cheaper. And they were trading these all around. There were collectors around the world, and they were paying huge amounts of money for them. Dutch tulip bulbs. What's a tulip bulb worth today? Tens of thousands of dollars? Well, that value evaporated somewhere along the way, didn't it? And then of course this rest of the story goes on, talks about how everybody knew when they got them they weren't going to last but a year, tops, and yet they would pay all this money for it. So the things that seem to be valuable in this world, their value can come and go in a heartbeat. So that's kind of the way life works. Questions, comments? All right. I need to turn a page here. Go over to John 10:10. Some of you, as soon as you see that, you're going to go, oh yeah, I knew what that was. Some of you already know what it is, and the rest of you will know soon. John 10:10. Yes. Well, Barry, read it for us.
I certainly will. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly.
Who's the thief?
Time.
Yep. In a way, but Satan. Satan's the imposter. Satan's the one that comes up another way. Satan's the one that wants to take away your life, kill you, make you an enemy of God. That's the same thing, right? But Jesus said, I came that they would have life, Zoe, meaningful life, and have it, not just have it, but have it abundantly. In today's world, it is so easy to see the abundant life as the one that lets you do all the things you want to do, have the things you want to have, experience things that other people don't get to experience, and just, you know, one big vacation or whatever. I mean, we all have our own image of what the world would be telling us is an abundant life. Maybe for you the abundant life might even be, because I heard this from somebody recently, well, in my family, and I'll let them remain nameless, but the question was, well, when do you get to the point that, you just have the funds to do the things that, you really need to do, that you don't have to, never. I mean, there's always something out there that you go, oops, I got to do this, and I'm going to have to wait for the money or do something. But, so I don't know what abundant means to you from a worldly perspective, or what the world's tried to entice you with being what abundant is. But was Jesus talking about stuff here? Mm-mm. What was Jesus talking about?
Contentment.
Yeah. How about, look at what he told Peter when he came to Peter. Here's Peter out here. We assume successful, but I don't know. Fisherman. Owned all the gear. Not just for fun fishermen, like many of us, but commercial fisherman out there making his living, catching fish, providing it to the food supply for Israel. Follow me and I'll make you fishers of men. It wasn't just follow me and I'll make you content, was it? I mean, there is something about being involved in the work that God has put, is doing here on this earth, and being a part of that, that is a huge privilege. That's life. That's when you see I'm doing things that have eternal consequence, not because I'm doing them, but because God just allowed me to participate while he's doing his work. And so Jesus came to give us an abundant life, and it's not about things. It's about his kingdom. That's what Jesus talked about, the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of heaven. That's what these parables often talk about. We haven't had too many of them yet, but they're coming. The kingdom of heaven is like, and then you get a parable. And so that's what the abundant life is. You probably have some good things to add. Comments? Questions? Yes, sir.
I was just going to say, a lot of times people will think that abundant life is, say, you have money, you give to this organization for children or this other social organization or that kind of stuff. You can have those same attitudes yet still dishonor God.
Oh, you can. You can also, though, that can also be part of the abundant living. When I was in college, at the Christian college, I didn't get to meet them, but we were told about donors to the school, and they donated to a lot of things. And these are what you and I would call regular people. And this has started for them about 1960. At the time I was in college, I graduated in 80, so over a 20-year span. At the beginning of their married life and their careers, just working regular jobs, not business people getting feasts and famine or any of that, just working a job, they set a goal by the end of their life. They wanted to give away $1 million. And that was their top goal. Well, they lived extremely frugally, drove junk, did whatever it took to try to maximize their giving. And we were told about, because they were celebrating, that 20 years into their marriage, they'd already accomplished that, so they were working on the second million. And they were extremely happy people, I'm told. I never got to meet them, but they said, if you get to meet them, you're going to recognize it, because these folks are just on top of the world, and they've got virtually nothing. But they've given away, at that time, about $1 million. If you roll that back into 60s and 70s, that's a lot of money. So, there you go. Lots of contrasts here. Main thing is, where's your heart? Is it yours or is it God's? What are you doing with it? Are you laying up for yourselves treasures in a money belt that will never get bothered? Yes, sir.
Another thing, a guy was talking to him once about, you know, sometimes you give money. Churches are faced with a problem. They give money to the guy who maybe is going to go out and use it on drugs. But the guys, it's like Harvard and Yale. People gave them lots and lots of money over the years, and today they're dens of iniquity, basically. So you say, well, we shouldn't have done that. But as the guy said, God is not going to look at how he's going to look at you because you gave it, not that guy.
Your heart's what God's interested in.
Yeah.
And God will take care of the folks that manage what you give them. Now, don't get me wrong, we ought to not be foolish givers. But anyway, let's close. Go ahead.
If the Lord has told you, or you really have really have prayed about it and searched your heart and think that that's the right place, it's not ours to judge whether it's been spent wisely or not. It's ours to say, did I obey God?
Well, and that's an interesting thing. I mean, once you give the money, just for a moment, just stepping on the other side of that for a minute as a church. Now, we haven't had too much of an issue here, just a smidgen a time or two. The church I grew up, it was more of an issue. People would give money or give things, and now you've got a sacred cow, or you've got somebody besides the church leadership to answer to, or the church leadership finds themselves answering to a giver. Those are really awkward situations. If you're going to give it, once you give it, it's given. I'll just talk about one from my own family. I had an uncle that died of cancer when he was 18. He was a pretty good musician, sang a lot in the church. The piano the church had was junk. My grandparents went and bought this really, really nice piano. It didn't have room for like a baby grand or something, so it was an upright. But it was designed for the church. It actually had louvers that let the sound come out toward the player so that you could let, You could, anyway, it was nice. It was not cheap. Well, that was, let's see, he would have died in 64 or 65, maybe 66. Now let's go to today's, how old is that piano? But everybody's afraid to do anything with it because it was a memorial for my uncle. Now, I don't know if it's still that way, but a decade or two ago, it was kind of like my grandmother, who was in the nursing home then and was kind of out of it. But anyway, they were like, well, what would Fern have us do? That was my grandmother. She was the one left living. Well, I don't know. Do what you need to do. Well, we don't want to. So anyway, yeah. When you give your gift, let it be given and move on. Let's close with prayer. Lord, you are kind and gracious to us. You have given us a lot, which in many days, Lord, that's a blessing. Also on many days, Lord, it can be a real problem, a temptation, can even turn into its own curse when we start to love it too much, love it at all. Lord, just let us get the message you want from this. Bring conviction where conviction is needed. Lord, I do pray personally very much that you would really give a spiritual pat on the back to those that use their funds for your kingdom and give well. Lord, for those of us that struggle with giving with a good attitude, Lord, teach us and move us and change us so that we can know the absolute joy of being rich toward you and poor toward money and to ourselves. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.